With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome back to The Movie Palace, a new podcast taking a look at the films of old Hollywood. As ever, I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and I'm absolutely delighted to be joined on this episode by none other than film critic and podcaster, expert podcaster, Darren Mooney. Hello, Darren.
Hi, Carl. How are things?
Things are very well, thanks. And I'm really looking forward to discussing Charles Vidor's Gilda from 1946, which is kind of the order of business today, isn't it?
It is indeed. It is indeed one of those great film noirs, one that I actually have a very fond sort of memory of. I think I saw it on a restored film print in the Irish Film Institute, which is a great way to see a film noir, and particularly an old film like this, you know?
Absolutely. It's going to be really fascinating to sort of break it down. Let's start, though, Darren, with just a bit of chat about, you know, who you are and what you get up to. So for those listeners who don't know, I guess the main place to find your work online is the movie blog, isn't it? So perhaps you could just tell us a little bit about, you know, what the movie blog is, what kind of stuff you cover, and so on.
The movie blog is basically a website that I started in 2009 because people were sick of hearing me talk about things that I wanted to talk about. Talk about movies, films, television, pop culture, comic books, even some little theatre in there as well. So basically I set up the movie blog in 2009, I believe. I think my first review on it might even have been the X-Men Origins Wolverine movie, which is sort of an inauspicious debut. But then basically over time it sort of evolved into... It's relatively personal. It's not quite a big site. Like, it's obviously not Screen Crush or Slash Film or anywhere like that, or you know, sort of Film Daily or whatever, Screen Daily or anything like that. It's a relatively personal blog in that I cover the material that I want to cover. So, you know, I'll go through phases where I'll cover particular films in particular series, or I'll go through phases where I talk about comic books for a little bit, or I'll go through like season by season through particular shows. So, for example, you and I would know each other, Carl, through the work on the X-Cast, the wonderful podcast that Tony Black organizes. And one of the things that I did for the website was I covered absolutely every episode of the X-Files from beginning to end, with various tie-in comic books, various spin-offs, all the crossovers, points of intersection, little bits of trivia along the way. And I went through them basically episode by episode over the course of, I think, about 4 years, and in a great deal of depth. And so that was sort of like a project that I was kind of interested in doing. And then it's that sort of thing. So I've done Star Trek as well. I've done bits of Doctor Who. I've done movie series. I also review weekly as well. I'm sort of lucky enough over here in that I do get to review current releases. The studios occasionally invite me to go see movies. So if you log on, you'll typically see reviews of like the upcoming release and stuff like that. So, you know, Mission Impossible, The Equalizer 2, that sort of stuff around the time we're recording.
But you've coined the term like non-review review as a kind of descriptor for what you do. So what does that mean exactly?
Well, I think that was sort of a thing when I was younger and I was sort of like punky, yeah. And I was, you know, like when you're young and rebellious. I should point out, I started the blog when I was about 20, which makes me feel super old now. But it was this young sort of hip thing. I was like this punk guy, was going to do things by my own rules. And I sort of like, obviously like, And it's interesting because you go back and you read your earlier stuff. I assume you have the same thing as well. Like, if you have earlier stuff that you've written and you go, what the hell was I thinking? I was an idiot. What am I doing here? But yeah, the non-review aspect of it is, it originated from when I was, you know, 20-something and I was like, I want to write about film. I don't want to write in a rigorously sort of formulaic way that I saw a lot of mainstream reviewers writing, particularly at the time. This is around about the 2000s, so this would have been the time of, like, Ain't It Cool News, for example, but of, like, geek-centric film sites that were very much about trying to impose, like, you see it even now with this discussion of, like, objective reviews of material, where it's like you give a score out of 10, but it's actually out of 100, and you grade on various curves because you can measure the metric worth of a movie using a 1 to 10 scale or a 5 stars or a thumbs up and a thumbs down. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to more talk about the film and the experience of watching the film and being honest what the film meant to me in that sort of like personal diary sort of way. So non-review review is basically my excuse for being, you know, somebody sits down and they go, yeah, well, you didn't talk about how good Tom Cruise's performance was in this Mission Impossible film. And I can go, yeah, but I was more interested in talking about things like its exploration, the nuclear family, or going off for 10 minutes about the weird misogyny that, you know, Robert Towne wrote into the script, or, you know, John Woo's fixation on doves. Like, I want to talk about things that interest me in the film. And I feel like the non-review review title sort of gave me the freedom to kind of go off and to do it in my own way. So people didn't expect like a list of cast members or, you know, a sort of a discussion of like point by point, like the film, the screenplay is good, the direction is good, and just sort of like talk, freewheel it a little bit, you know?
What about for those people who favour podcasting over the written word then? So I guess for those people, the best place to hear you is the 250, isn't it? And IMDb kind of centered podcast with a nice little hook, I think. So how would you kind of pitch that to people?
This was an idea that began with one of my friends when he basically sat down and said we should do a podcast because we like hanging out together and we like, you know, engaging in conversation together, and we thought that we'd share it with the world because now everybody can be our friend. It was a thing. He was very interested in this. He thought it'd be an interesting thing to do. And I was interested in this, and I enjoy spending time with him. And my basic condition was that if we were going to do a podcast, it would be about something that I was relatively, you know, not entirely uninformed about. So we sort of settled on doing a film podcast, and we sort of went through various permutations. What we do, would we do like a, you know, Kermode and Mayo style, like Week in Review? Would we do a classics podcast like this one, for example? Would we do something like go through the AFIs, go through one of those like 100 years, 100 lists, you know, sort of 100 movies lists? And what we sort of settled on was we said that, well, we take a look at the Internet Movie Database's top 250 movies of all time, which is the list that exists on the IMDb as ranked by voters, basically depicting what the internet has through consensus agreed to be the top 250 movies of all time. And we wanted to do that for a number of reasons. First thing was we didn't want to do a Sight and Sound poll or an AFI poll because we found that they could be quite academic in places. And, you know, that's not like a, you know, reverse snobbery or anti-elitism thing on our part. That's just like myself and Andrew are good friends. We are not experts in film. We love movies. We love going to the cinema. We've digested a huge amount of cinema, but we don't feel really comfortable talking about stuff like Tarkovsky in great detail or like pretending to be experts in like the history of world cinema. We feel that would have been disingenuous. So the IMDb list is a lot more populous, a lot more mainstream, and it's a lot more dynamic as well, in that it's a list where you can see things changing and shifting, stuff coming in, going out over time, and you can sort of see trends and you can extrapolate from them. So you can see, like, for example, the fact that nearly every Marvel movie has gotten into the list on its opening weekend, with the notable exception of Black Panther, that sort of thing. Or you can see that, for example, over the past couple of years, Woody Allen's films have actually dropped significantly on the list through live voting, and you can see that that's something that's happening in real time. You can see stuff like the embrace of Eastern cinema, particularly Japanese cinema, as the list becomes more and more diverse in that respect over time as well. And so you have this interesting, like, back and forth. I mean, and it's actually, it's something I'm really proud of, not because I think the podcast is brilliant or anything like that. I'm I'm very glad to be part of it. But it's more that it's been a fun experience for myself and I hope for Andrew as well, because we've like gotten to know people through it and friends through it, and particularly people who know more about film than we do. I think one of our edicts is that we should always be the least informed people on the podcast. We try to have good guests and we've done a great job. So we have people who know about like Bollywood and Indian cinema, because Indian cinema is like a huge part of what the list is now. And so we have people who actually know what they're talking about, and we can see them with our own eyes, and we can sort of like compare them to our own frame of reference and then sort of discuss them in the context of what they mean in Indian cinema versus what they mean in world cinema. It's an ongoing experiment, and it's very interesting. We maybe should have picked a shorter list in hindsight, though.
So what, you've been going for like, was it a couple of years now almost? Is that about right?
We'll be going about 2 years in November, I think about 100 episodes. So we release roughly once per week, which is something that we're quite proud of. They tend to be quite lengthy, and they tend to be quite discursive in that we tend to go off on tangents. So for example, I think we spend a full 10 minutes in our Blade Runner episode talking about how men's bodies have evolved as depicted on screen, because Harrison Ford shirtless in Blade Runner is radically different than Ryan Gosling shirtless in Blade Runner 2049. And sort of like, you can sort of extrapolate that trend through the 80s and 90s. And so we go off on these like weird little tangents. It's basically two guys hanging out talking about things they noticed while watching the film. And you know, we hope that people enjoy it a great deal, but it is quite rambly, and we will concede that.
You can do that as well with the Bond films, can't you? You can compare Sean Connery's physique to like Daniel Craig's, and you know, the dad pod has kind of gone out of style, I guess.
Well, that's the thing about doing it with a list like this, is because we hop from like the 50s to the 90s and stuff, and we get to see little changes and things like inappropriate smoking. It's incredible how much people used to smoke in movies.
Now, did you look at what Gilda gets is currently rated at on the IMDb or not? Or would you like to venture a guess?
I figure it's a high 7, so I'm going to go with like a 7.8.
You're so close, it's unreal. 7.7.
Damn it, I get a good sense of these things.
Yeah, from about 23,000 votes at the time of recording. I mean, what does that mean? I mean, how do old movies fare in terms of ratings? Because I know it seems to me it's kind of weaponized the ratings for like new movies, but I don't know how old movies fare in that respect.
Well, the issue is that basically the list is very much sort of anchored in a particular mindset. We noticed as we're doing it. It's very much, I think there's a great quote about like the golden age of science fiction being 12. And it seems like it's very much that for the IMDb. The golden age of movies is being like 12 in 1994. And you can see that like when you go through by decade, you can see that they sort of dominate. You have a lot of movies like, you know, 40 movies from, you know, the current decade, which is an absurd amount on the top 250 movies of all time. You have 50 decades from like 2000 through 2009. You have 41 movies from 1990 through to 1999. Do you want to guess how many movies you have from, say, 1930 to 1939 there, Carl? Just to turn this around on you.
Oh.
Out of 250.
Out of 250. I'm going to say like, I don't know, like 15 maybe? I don't know.
7.
Do you know what they are?
They are, hold on, I have the list here. City Lights.
Okay, yeah.
Modern Times. M. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Gone with the Wind. It Happened One Night. And The Wizard of Oz. Which is kind of like, if you were to pick the movies from the 30s, those would be a pretty good shout.
I was going to say, it was interesting because I think three of them, I believe, are from 1939, which kind of people talk about as like Hollywood's miracle year and stuff. Yeah,
there is indeed. Yeah, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Gone with the Wind, and Wizard of Oz are all 1939 as well. There's, I think it gets slightly better as you go on. There's, I think, somewhere around 11 movies from the 1940s and 25 from the 50s. But it is a list that's very much geared towards more modern sensibilities.
Let's chat a little then about film noir as a genre in general before we come on to Gilda specifically. I mean, I've always found the world of noir like very enthralling, you know. I don't know, for some reason, the distinctive features like we associate with a genre just really got their hooks into me, you know. It's all the things, you know, we could list off, you know, Private Eyes and these kind of labyrinthine narrative structures and like really expressionist lighting and stuff like that. So I don't know, some of my very favourite films are noirs. And I'm thinking about stuff like Double Indemnity or In a Lonely Place or Otto Preminger's Laura. But what about you, Darren? How deep is your interest in noir?
I feel kind of like I'm an imposter on this podcast because like I absolutely adore, I would have came of age like watching through my grandparents the like the movies of the late 60s and 70s, the neo-noirs almost, the new Hollywood, the stuff that was heavily influenced by this. And like I would have gone back when I was in college and I would have watched a lot of like the silent films, obviously the Keaton and Chaplin and Lloyd, and even the German Expressionism of the 20s. And I have an interesting relationship with the films of the 30s and the 40s, the sort of the golden age of cinema that everybody absolutely adores, where I respect them a lot, and I think they're deeply, deeply fascinating, and they are absolutely 110% the building blocks of modern cinema as we know them. And I think there are some absolutely great films there, films that I love. I also have this interesting sort of push and pull with it, where... And it's particularly with regards to noir, because noir is absolutely beautiful. It's obviously heavily influenced by German Expressionism. You point out the use of lighting, the moral ambiguity, the sense of like this simmering beneath the surface, this sort of like Jungian and almost like Freudian tension that exists, where none of the film noirs are actually about what they're actually about. And it's great that we're talking about Gilda, because one of the reasons I actually really like Gilda is because it's a movie that makes absolutely no sense if you look at what's happening on screen, but makes a great deal of sense once you look at how the characters are interacting and what the film is sort of saying and suggesting about those interactions without saying them. And you have this thing with the Hays Code and the Breen Office and stuff like that, where you have this, like, you can't actually articulate a lot of what these movies are about, which creates an interesting tension where at one point everything has to be more abstract and more metaphorical and less literal, which is kind of, it lends them this nice poetic quality, which I really, really admire and which really resonates and I think is a large part of kind of why they've endured as they have. But at the same time, there's a little part of me that maybe suspects that the fact that you couldn't articulate these things and you couldn't say these things, and that you sort of codified this sort of almost puritanical aspect of kind of storytelling, in some ways hindered cinema in the mainstream sort of way, particularly in an American context. Where I think that there's a certain... And again, it's not just the Hays Code. I think you can trace it back to stuff like Prohibition, but even like the Puritans and stuff like that. There's this sort of aspect of noir where part of me wants them to just say what they're saying and do what they're doing without having to obscure it or sort of mask it or to add this veneer of, we're not really talking about, you know, two men who are having an illicit affair that's ruined by the arrival of a woman. And just sort of actually just tear that off and go, okay, this, we're actually having this conversation now. So it's, I absolutely adore it. I think they're lovely, but I have this sort of interesting sort of push and pull relationship with them, if that makes sense.
It does make sense and it is interesting. And I think another like sort of, you know, push and pull aspect is that noir is a great vehicle for interrogating like masculinity and stuff, but how much does it interrogate it really is the question sometimes, I think. And perhaps we can get into that a bit in respect to Gilda. Now, I think I suggested this one, didn't I? Now, I've had seen this film a couple of times before, and I'll tell you the reason why I suggested it actually is because I've never been able to quite decide whether this is like an absolute top tier noir, like a, you know, is it up there with Double Indemnity? Or is it right at the top of like the second tier? You know, I suppose to put it in crude terms, it would be like, is it a 4-star or is it a 5-star? So I was kind of interested to go back and try and grapple with that a bit. The way I watch this, I don't know about you, but most recently was on, there's a really good Criterion release of the film.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure what the situation is in Ireland, but in the UK, we've only just started getting these Criterions about a year ago or something, you know, and we get like a limited range of them. Is it the same for you or not?
It is exactly. I know many of my more serious cinephile friends would actually have an international Blu-ray player specifically so they could watch the Criterion editions, because I think Criterion didn't actually region lock their DVDs, but they did region lock their Blu-rays, which is a very strange choice. But yeah, so I have a couple of like Criterion DVDs from America, but I don't have any Blu-rays. I have Blu-rays from the UK, which I got from Amazon. And it's interesting because Gilda was one of the first of the set. And it's actually, that would have been the last time I watched it before this weekend, before this recording, was when I got the Blu-ray and sat down and watched it. Because I have a whole bunch of the Criterions, because I've actually been trying to like delve into a little bit of history. I would have seen like, I only saw In a Lonely Place for the first time, I think about a year ago, as part of the Criterion release cycle, which is very cool. Now, I haven't done as much as I should have, but they're a really great sort of collector's resource. And yeah, so that would have been how I would have, I saw Gilda last before this weekend, obviously.
Now then, this film then. So I think this film works best as this kind of weird, beguiling love triangle almost, you know. It seems like it's motivated alternately by a mix of like unconcealed like lust and like outright hostility at times. I think my issue with the film, if I have one, is I find some of the other plot elements a bit less satisfying. But what about you, Darren? You said you've had an interesting kind of fondness for this film. So what do you make of it?
I mean, this is the thing where Gilda is in many ways like the archetypal sort of what I think about when I think about film noir, which is odd because you point out it's not really considered a top tier noir. It's like it's on the cusp. It's like a one that you seek out that if you're just sort of one below watching, I don't know, Casablanca, The Maltese Falcon or Double Indemnity, it's like, well, Gilda's also very good and sort of seeking it out that way and having it recommended like that. But it for me, captures a lot of like what I love and what I hate about it, which is ironic, as you pointed out, because it's a film about the extremes of love and hate. But it is very much like you're entirely correct when you say that the least interesting aspect of Gilda is the actual plot, is the actual like material, what's happening. It is possibly the most exciting movie that's ever been made about tungsten monopolies in the history of mankind. But I don't even mean that. I mean, in terms of plot, in terms of like the double crosses and the twists and in terms of what actually happens. But it is absolutely riveting and fascinating when you look at the interactions of the characters as they bounce off one another and what the film is saying, but also not saying, what it's leaving unsaid, what it's implying, what the actors are offering sort of through their performances. And even beyond that, I think there's a whole host of like interesting ideas simmering beneath the surface in terms of like politics and in terms of sexuality and in terms of just like other stuff like masculinity, the stuff that you talked about there, where the question is like, you know, do noirs like interrogate masculinity or do they, you know, reinforce conventional norms of it? There's this interesting sort of tension, and Gilda kind of is one of the better films that I've seen for like getting at that subtextually from the era. It's also one of the films that is most blatantly resisting the urge to do it on anything resembling a textual level. Like if you were to tell the story of Gilda to somebody, it would be a completely different experience from watching it. We're going to talk a little bit about the characters later on, but to give you an example, like when you describe the plot, the love triangle seems to take, you know, the obviously Gilda herself, the Rita Hayworth character, as the pivot point upon which this love triangle turns. However, if you watch the film, it becomes very clear that Gilda herself isn't the pivot point. It's Johnny who is the pivot point. But that comes through not through any dialogue or not through any like actual writing, more through like the staging, the performances and the deliveries as well. And it's kind of, there's this back and forth in there where it's like, this is a really good, like, and again, Jungian sort of Freudian sort of subtextual stuff. I think there's a point where Gilda says, you know, a psychiatrist would pay a great deal of attention to the words that you're using, as if to like wink at the camera and go, isn't that right, people in the audience? And it really does that for me. So I like it from that. But I think you're entirely right that it's a really, really messy, clumsily scripted, clumsily plotted. I mean, I have a, as a film, I'm not overly enamored with it, particularly in compared to the standards of the time. Like, I mean, there's a lot of awkward narration and exposition, for example. There are some really strange plotting choices in terms of when the movie chooses to make the audience aware of certain turns and twists and reveals, which we'll probably talk about when we get to those. There's some really clumsy, sharp, twisty left turn sort of like, oh, and then this thing happened, which is a huge deal. But I'm just going to mention it offhandedly. And the ending is absolutely nonsense when you compare it with absolutely everything that came before, but it exists because like the film can't be what it actually is. So you have this wonderful tension that is at once like intoxicating and also, if we're being honest, a little infuriating, which is like something very powerful in a film.
Yeah, in terms of the ending, that seems to happen a lot in films of this era. I mean, one of my favourite films is the Western Red River, and you know, it just has this ridiculous tacked on like happy ending, you know, and Gilda seems, you know, somewhat akin to that to me. I think once we get talking about these characters, we could be going all night. So before we do, let's talk about the look of the film, because one of the good features on that Blu-ray is there's a little featurette with Martin Scorsese and Baz Luhrmann. And at one point, Scorsese talks about Gilda as an example of the studio system at its best. And the reason he's saying that is he's talking about the combined artistry on display. And it seemed really apt to me. Because, I mean, you could look at, you know, some of the key collaborators, Hayworth, of course, I think. But somebody like Rudolf Matte's, his cinematography, really good. I mean, it's a great looking film, isn't it?
It absolutely is. It looks wonderful. There's a number of beautiful shots in there as well, where you're peering through windows, and you have that great shot after sort of like, you know, not, I assume if you're listening to this podcast, you've watched the movie, but where they're reading the will and like Johnny's in there with the guys and the camera, it's like moves through the window and then pans over to the door to catch up with them, giving you this nice sort of voyeuristic, sort of almost perverse sort of aspect of the film that plays into its themes. It looks stunning. I mean, and then obviously the choreography of Jack Cole, which we'll probably talk about a bit later on as well, the use of music, the costume design as well, which is absolutely fantastic. I think it's been argued that Gene Lewis, you know, has basically been credited as an essential ingredient in the formula that created the image of Rita Hayworth, and nowhere is that clearer than Gilda with the famous black dress.
Let's come on to Gilda, because I mean, she enters the film after about, I think it's like 17 minutes or something. So we meet Glenn Ford's Johnny first, don't we? And he gets a great little introduction, like the dice rolling scene, I think. Now then, what about him? Because I think when I think of like the great male noir protagonists, I think of people like, I don't know, somebody like Robert Mitchum, I guess, or Bogart, I think is the obvious one. I even sort of think of Jack Nicholson, because I mean, Chinatown, even though it's, you know, it's a neo-noir, I guess, but I think of that as one of my favourite noir films too. Now, is Ford quite in that league? I'm not sure. How effective is he?
I mean, isn't the famous story that Humphrey Bogart, I think, was considered or sort of considered the role, but then decided that he would have been overshadowed in it. It's an interesting role. I mean, I think it sort of works in large part because the character is kind of passive. In that I think that, like, Glenn Ford, it wouldn't work if Ford had, like, the raw masculine energy that you sort of associate with sort of film noir protagonists. If he had that sort of energy or even that sort of, like, gravity. In a way, the character of sort of, like, Johnny Farrell is caught in the orbit of these two figures, you know, Gilda and Balin. And it's sort of, it's kind of appropriate that you have Ford sort of, as this character who isn't, or as this actor who isn't this sort of charismatic screen presence in the way that I think many of his contemporaries were, because it lends the movie works, I think, in large part because of that.
I suppose a bit later on in the film, when he becomes a bit more of like a domineering figure, then I think that's where I perhaps don't buy him in the role quite so much. Yeah. One of the essays, one of the things I read about this film in preparation for this was an essay written by Richard Dyer about the film. And he had some interesting points about Ford's appearance here. He sort of contrasts it with, you know, how he'd appeared on the screen like previously. You know, he'd been in a few westerns and kind of action films before this. And, you know, in comparison to those films, here he's lit very softly. His hair's kind of oiled back, isn't it? And he's quite, like, fastidiously dressed. So I think what Dyer was kind of arguing is that the film kind of sets up Johnny as kind of a desirable object, you know, as Gilda will be later on. You know, even Gilda comments on his appearance on a number of occasions, saying he's pretty and so on.
And beautiful as well, yeah.
That's it, yeah. So I think Dyer's kind of saying that if Johnny's an object, in that, like a visual object in that sense, it perhaps calls into question the extent to which we take his judgments of Gilda as gospel, you know, in the voiceovers and so on. Because if he's an object, you know, the film is not necessarily being seen through his eyes as, you know, as much as we might assume. For a typical noir protagonist. I think that's a sound argument up to a point. I think maybe the film doesn't sustain it, you know, all the way through that way, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, weird back and forth about, like, masculinity, and particularly about, like, Johnny's agency within it as well. And particularly as the film sort of sees Gilda, where the film sort of seems to have this back and forth about whether Gilda is, like, this criminal mastermind or this force of nature, or she's this object onto which Johnny is projecting all of his masculine anxieties. And the film sort of goes back and forth on that, which I think you're right, is, you know, it might be down to the fact that, you know, you have the Breen office and the Hays Code, and you have these sort of like limitations on what you can do on screen. But there is definitely a bit of back and forth with it that doesn't quite work textually, I think, in terms of plot.
And of course, one of the fascinating features of the film is this relationship between Johnny and Balin, played by George MacReady. And as I'm sure you're aware, I think a lot of writers who've written about the film read this as kind of a gay relationship. And, you know, I think the evidence people point to is, you know, the way kind of Balin picks up Johnny at the start of the film. There's like all sorts of innuendo you could point to, even to the cane being kind of a phallic symbol. And, you know, Balin actually talks about wanting to penetrate Johnny with it at the end of the film, I think, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah, but he can't because then Gilda's there, which is like, okay, your subtext is now sort of on the verge of becoming text. It's like, I would love to penetrate you, but then this woman is here and it makes it really awkward. But yeah, there's a whole host of stuff within that. There's like the fact that Gilda tries to get her marriage to Johnny annulled, despite which means that it hasn't been consummated, which means that, you know, he's not a traditionally masculine figure. You have lines like, you know, what's it? The great scene where Johnny goes up to the office and offers a glass of champagne and says, I thought we ought to celebrate too. Later on, he says to Balin, you know, we should go home, you know, and you know, that this sort of kinky back and forth where Balin is like, I need my little friends to be obedient. Wait for me at home. I may need both my little friends. And then, you know, sort of like when they arrive, oh, the introductory line as well, which is like, yeah. You know, a cane like that is handy. It is a faithful friend. Mostly silent, but talks when I need it to. That's your idea of a friend. You must lead a gay life. Which is like, you know, it's 1946. Okay, gay means happy and joyful. But at that stage, gay also means wink, wink, nudge, nudge. There's a lot of stuff. Oh, and I particularly love when Johnny comes back with Gilda from their late night swim. And Balin's like, oh, you'll have to teach me how to swim.
Yeah, it makes me wonder how the kind of typical, you know, moviegoer of 1946 would have perceived this, you know. Because I wonder, you know, I think the audience reception of this film would have made like an interesting study, wouldn't it?
It is. It's interesting to sort of imagine like picking through it. Because the film goes absolutely out of its way textually to avoid like following through on a lot of these implications. So you could watch it and you could be oblivious to it if you chose to be. Like, there's a lot of stuff where you can see, like, famously, I think the Breen office, this is really supposed to be a straight gangster story set in America. But they moved it to Buenos Aires because that allowed a bit more freedom in sort of the presentation of sexual mores and stuff like that. They had, you know, the marriage at the end where, you know, Gilda and Johnny go off into the sunset together to live happily ever after, despite the fact you're not about 10 minutes away from talking about how much they hate each other with a deep abiding passion and want to make each other suffer. And you have this sort of like back and forth. Oh, you have like the detective revealing that like all of Gilda's like infidelities and like the cuckolding that sort of runs through the script, this sort of like cheating in affairs, they definitely didn't happen. So it's perfectly fine. Absolutely nothing kinky happened over the course of this film, despite your best efforts. And so I think that there is that layer of plausible deniability, which makes me wonder, yeah, I think it would be interesting to talk about people or talk to people coming out of this film in 1946 and go, so you didn't get any subtext then, did you?
It'd be absolutely fascinating, wouldn't it? But I think the time's come. I think we should talk about Gilda. Let's just talk, first of all, about that first shot, you know, because I think when I think of this film, that's the first image that springs to mind, you know.
When she does that shit with her hair.
Yeah, exactly. As they say, that's the Shawshank Redemption, isn't it? Yeah. Just the way she kind of bounces into frame, it's so dynamic. What did you make of that shot?
I think it's one of the great character introductions. It reminds me of Orson Welles' introduction in The Third Man. And that, like, it's one of those, like, you have that frame. And, like, even if you haven't seen the film, you're probably familiar with that shot. And then later on, obviously, the sort of striptease that's not really a striptease to put the blame on Mame. And it's, like, it's an iconic part of what the film is. And, I mean, you're right when you point out The Shawshank Redemption, which I think is a huge part of it. Because if you haven't seen Gilda, you've probably seen those frames of Gilda projected, like, on the in The Shawshank Redemption when Morgan Freeman's watching the film, and like that's your association with Rita Hayworth. It's an absolutely brilliant, and also like the line as well, oh me, decent, yes I'm decent, which is, it becomes like a recurring motif that runs through the film as well. It's a great introduction.
Now then, I think the question about her is she a femme fatale or is she not? Because if you depending on who you read about this film, she's either the ultimate femme fatale or she isn't a femme fatale whatsoever. So I think what's interesting about Hayworth as a noir female lead is that because she's already an established star, you know, she's bringing some positive associations to the film with her, you know. And I think when I think of femme fatales, I think usually they're sort of set up as unknowable, enigmatic women. So I think maybe her stardom kind of runs counter to that. But what do you make of her? Is she a femme fatale? Do you think of her as one?
there's an interesting sort of back and forth in the film, and I think we sort of alluded to it earlier, with regards to how the film treats Gilda and how it treats her agency and stuff like that. Because there's this recurring motif that runs through the film where, like, Gilda is basically treated as the woman who's going to ruin everything that's going on here. Like, it's Gilda's going to show up and she's going to be a natural disaster. She's going to tear them apart. You know, there, you have this whole back and forth, you know, about sort of like disaster to the wench who did wrong by our Johnny, when she's actually toasting herself, ironically enough, right? Which suggests that, yeah, she is going to be the force that, like, ruins and tears them apart. And you have this sort of, obviously, the fact that, like, Johnny kissing Gilda, getting seen by Balin, you know, then turns out to be this big thing that leads towards the messy climax where Balin tries to murder them but gets killed by sweet Uncle Peo. But it's okay because the law enforcement official brushed it all under the carpet. But at the same time, there's this interesting subtext that runs through the film about how it isn't necessarily Gilda herself that does this. It's the projections that the male characters sort of put upon her. And, like, that's the thing with the put the blame on Mame, which is basically about how these natural disasters happen. Like, she talks about the quake of 1906 and how we respond to that is we put the blame for those disasters on women. We treat women as these natural disasters that tear men apart, when it's very clear, like, that looking at it, that, you know, Johnny and Balin are not a particularly healthy couple anyway. One of them is like a grifter who was caught, you know, gambling with loaded dice on the Docklands. Balin is working with Nazis in order to set up a tungsten monopoly. Like, there was no way that their relationship was ever going to be tenable. And there's a sense watching Gilda that, like, Gilda's actual intervention, she isn't even that much of a catalyst for this. As much as Johnny talks about needing to get Gilda out in order to protect Balin, there's a sense that, like, Gilda is just as caught up in this as the rest of them. She's just a convenient scapegoat in a literal sense.
Yeah, and to go back to that song, you know, like you say, the lyrics are all about the wrongness, it's, you know, of men blaming women for X, Y, and Z. But that's kind of what the noir world is all about, isn't it? That's one way of reading it anyway, is that it's all about men, you know, pinning the blame on women. So it probably goes back to, like, the tension we said at the heart of the film, I guess.
It does indeed. Like, I mean, you can read the film, like, the textually, if you were to describe the film to somebody, it would be like, okay, well, there are these two guys and they're hanging out in Buenos Aires and they're having a great time. And then all of a sudden, one of them gets married. And it turns out that he's getting married to this woman who actually has a past association with the guy with whom he's in business. And so they have a back and forth, and there's, like, maybe a secret attraction between, you know, the best friend and the wife, and this sort of blossoms, and, you know, all of a sudden they end up in an affair, and then the guy dies, and, you know, his friend is really conflicted about it. If you were describing in those terms, it would seem like Gilda is, like, the nexus or the pivot point. But when you watch it, it's very clear that, like, Balin seems to be competing as much for Johnny as for Gilda, in that, like, Gilda's very much into Johnny and very much, like, wants Johnny, whereas Johnny himself is caught between wanting Gilda and very clearly wanting Balin and not being able to have both at the same time. And it's sort of his choices that cause the problem. Like, what you could probably construct an argument that, like, Johnny Farrell is, like, the femme fatale of Gilda if you wanted to so introduce it, in that, like, the plot would probably... It'd probably work relatively well if you took him out, because Balin would have escaped with Gilda and would have lived possibly happily ever after without the instigation of, like, Gilda trying to get a rise out of Johnny. Because you have all this weird voyeurism stuff, and, like, you have this really kinky subtext that runs through the film, which I don't think we've really discussed yet, where you have this sort of, like, Gilda repeatedly seems to get off on the fact that Johnny's watching her. Like, there's a moment where somebody offers to buy her a drink at the bar, this guy, and she's like, oh, no, I couldn't. And then she spots that Johnny's watching her. She's like, okay, I'll go and I'll do as this spectator sport. Later on, she brings a man back to the house, and, you know, Johnny's standing there in the shadows, and she's like, oh, I think someone is watching us. And you have this sort of, like, tension of performance in what she's doing. And you have even sort of, like, this observation where, like, Johnny himself talks about how he would love to go back and watch them, but without them knowing that he's watching them. Or later on, when he's driving her to and from all these illicit rendezvous where he's an observer but not a participant. You have this sort of weird dynamic at play, which is kind of absolutely fascinating, but which I think genders Johnny in an interesting way compared to Gilda.
Yeah, because I think... the film allows her a bit more of a gaze than would typically be the case for a woman in noir, I think. In terms of her as a femme fatale, I can't think of any other noir leading ladies who dance, you know. I think the dance is quite fascinating here, you know, because there's an argument that when we talk about women as like visual objects, you know, there's an argument that staticness or stasis is what kind of what fixes like a woman as an object of desire. If you think about like pinup pictures, for example, but that, you know, women can escape from this through movement. So I don't know, you've got this really expressive Latin American style dancing, it looked like to me, that Hayworth does here. And I don't know, just in general, I find those second two, the second and the third musical numbers interesting. You know, I suppose the second one, I think it's Amado Mio. That's almost kind of superfluous in one sense. It almost seems to represent a temporary pause in terms of the plot movement. Or at least that's how I saw it. What do you reckon?
Well, I mean, we should talk about this. The plot is absolutely bonkers. I think the choreographer talked about getting script pages like on the morning of. So the film has all these like weird dead ends and tangents and sort of like strange sequences where Gilda like leaves the country and then comes back as part of an elaborate ruse that was somehow orchestrated by Johnny in order to illustrate how completely he trapped her, which makes no sense in terms of plot, but works very well in terms of like this Freudian aspect. And it's kind of interesting that you should talk about like the idea of the film noir, sort of the femme fatale being sort of stuck as an object in stasis. That's literally what Johnny's trying to do. He's trying to trap her in one place. She leaves and then he brings her back as if trying to like fix her in a single place. It is interesting. Like, I really like the Argentinian setting of the film because it plays into all this sort of subtext. Like, there's a great bit where they're talking about like Carnival, which is like when Balin fakes his death. But that's 3 days before Lent, where everybody just lets out all this pent-up frustration. You know, it's sort of like sowing the seeds before reaping the harvest is how Gilda describes it. But it's very much about shedding your inhibitions and just like releasing what's inside yourself. And it sort of plays into this sort of like subtext of the noir stuff that we're sort of talking about. Like, there's even stuff like the use of the tango, which is an interesting dance because they talk about it a little bit. Well, they don't talk about it here, but like I've read a bunch of stuff about the history of the tango, which is considered an erotic dance just based on like many people who watch it. Because it is, when you watch it, it's very much, it's rhythmic. It looks like it should be something that's sexual. But if you look at the history of it, what the tango actually is, it's the dance of isolation and loneliness, where, for example, in cafes and brothels, men would dance the tango with one another in order to celebrate their loneliness or to acknowledge their loneliness and to feel a connection to one another. It's almost like thwarted, like sexual contact, which is very appropriate for the film that it's in, because like all the dancing is many ways like a substitute for this sort of like sexual expression that none of the characters can have. You have like Gilda trying to strip on stage but getting no further than her gloves because she's basically dragged off and like basically forced. She's not allowed to acknowledge or release her sexuality because it has to be contained. And you have this sort of simmering current that runs through it. I mean, you have that as well with that sort of like escape where she literally tries to escape from Johnny by running away, but then ends up being brought back again as well.
Yeah, and I mean, the use of musical numbers, I think these are some of my, you know, favourite scenes in the whole picture, really. Even though the film generally, it's got a fairly protracted running time. It's like 1 hour 50. You know, I think overall maybe it could have been a bit more taut, but you know, whatever the case, I definitely wouldn't have wanted to lose those musical sequences.
Oh, definitely. Like, I mean, the most expendable thing in Gilda is the actual plot as it unfolds.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, oh, tungsten monopolies and like antitrust laws. It's like, well, this is riveting, whatever this is happening. And there's lots of weird choices. So, for example, like Balin, when he crashes his plane, and it's like the audience knows he's not dead and he's going to come back at the climax, but you somehow have to include a shot of him getting on a dinghy to confirm that he's not dead. There's a lot of really odd stuff like that. Whereas the stuff that you're right, the stuff that is most inessential to the plot. So, for example, that like Gilda runs away and then is brought back sequence, which gives us the first of those dancing numbers. But also like even the nightclub sequence as well, which is, you know, a little indulgent. They're the heart of what the film is doing. And they probably say more than those scenes of characters like bantering back and forth and delivering exposition and like actually explaining how the plot works and like having these sort of like, can Johnny trust Balin? What is Balin actually up to? Sort of stuff that's happening in the background.
in terms of the plot, I wonder, you know, it seems kind of its time in the sense that at about the same time you had Hitchcock did Notorious, and I think that's got some kind of subplot about uranium that works a bit better than the tungsten stuff in Gilder, has to be said. I think in The Guardian, Peter Bradshaw described this film as the crazy evil twin of Casablanca, which I liked, because, you know, you've got both films have got this kind of exoticized setting, you know. You've got characters away from home, and the thing is, they may not be able to return home, so that the film setting becomes kind of like a liminal space, doesn't it? And the other comparison being that between Casablanca and Gilda, that you've got these sinister German characters involved in the plot, you know.
It is worth noting, just in terms of that, like, Casablanca's evil twin, which is a great comparison of it. And as you pointed out, all the similarities that exist in terms of, like, the ominous German characters and the Americans who are stranded far from home. This is very much a post-World War II film. I think this was Glenn Ford's first film after he'd served in the army during the Second World War. And, like, there's a moment early in the film, which is one of those moments where we talk about, like, the voiceover narration feeling like it was kind of cobbled together and improvised, where it's like, oh, very quickly I rose in the ranks and became Balin's number one associate. Oh, by the way, then the war ended. And you're like, oh, okay, that's what we're doing now. But it has this weird sort of, like, interesting tension that runs through it about, and I wonder if this is either intentional, like, in terms of, like, it being a product of the studio system in 1946, or if it's just something that sort of twigged with me watching it through hindsight, where it has this sort of, like, post-World War II, like, American global order thing going on, where there's this sort of, like, idea of Americans abroad who are trying to exert influence. This would have been a year before the Truman Doctrine, for example, established, like, Latin America as a priority for the United States in preventing, like, the ascent of or the rise of communism in these sorts of states. And you have this sort of, like, tension where the bar is taken into, like, government ownership, which in some ways feels like a concern about communism, but you also have this idea of, like, a monopoly and a control that's governed by these Americans who are very clearly foreigners. And there's this interesting tension with Uncle Pio, where Uncle Pio is basically like, you know, oh, you're a peasant and I will be here long after you leave. But, like, Balin and Johnny sort of seeking to set themselves up as, like, the kings of this strange foreign land to capitalize on the opportunity that comes after the end of the Second World War. I mean, it's also, like, interesting that Balin, like, has basically inherited this from a bunch of Nazis. Because, of course, this is Argentina after the Second World War. Of course there are Nazis hanging around. But, yeah, Balin's sort of, like, he's taken these things in trust from the Nazis. He, you know, the scheme was that they would pay him a great deal of money. He'd take ownership and he'd transfer it back to them afterwards and everything would be fine. But he's decided to sort of to hang on to it and to basically force his competitor out of business. It makes me wonder if there's a sense of, like, in 1946, looking at America's role in the world, where after, like, Europe is in ruins, after, like, Germany has collapsed, after Great Britain has been absolutely ravaged by the Second World War, if America's sort of looking at the world and going, okay, well, we're going to be in charge now. It's basically, by default, we're going to be the guiding light. Forget the isolationism of the, you know, of the 20s. Forget the movement to keep us out of the Second World War. Forget America first. It's like, we are basically going to be the global superpower because it's us or the Russians. And we have to come to terms with that. And I was watching that and I was wondering, is that an aspect of it? Is that, like, something that kind of comes out? Because I'm wondering, like, if you set this in America, as the plot was originally meant to be set, it was originally meant to be a straightforward gangster film, you'd lose a lot of that sort of tension that exists, which is kind of fascinating because none of it's really articulated, but it's all there. It's like Balin talking to Johnny about how I bought her just as I bought you. There's, you know, the all three of us with no pasts isn't that interesting, where it's like these guys who have gone to this place and they've reinvented themselves. But they've also, it's not just that they've reinvented themselves, they have a future now. It's like they've emerged fully formed. And I kind of, like, it's something that kind of simmers beneath the surface. It's never directly addressed. And you're entirely right that the tungsten stuff is not the most interesting part of the movie textually. But it does, like, in the context of being a film that was released in 1946, that stuff sort of feels like an interesting thematic thread rather than a plot thread to me.
I mean, in terms of Gilda as, you know, a product of 1946 and Gilda as a post-World War II film, I was kind of thinking of it in another sense. So let's talk about this and then we'll come back and we'll circle back to the ending and stuff. But, you know, the film did well at the box office in the US. I think the reviews, the contemporary reviews for the film were a bit more mixed. But this is one of those films that got a great response from the French critics, you know. And I think the thing is, it would have been seen as like this kind of glut of, well, not just noir films, but American films, you know, because France had been cut off from American releases during the war. And then they were kind of inundated with stuff, you know, once the war ended. And like, for me, that just, I just think of it, it must have been like this heavenly experience just to be kind of able to suddenly see, I don't know, whatever, you know, the Maltese Falcon and whatever, you know. I wonder if that's part of why Gilda then goes on to have, you know, the kind of cult reputation it does have, you know, because of the French reception of it.
It does indeed. Well, I mean, yeah, there's a huge sort of, like, that's a very important kind of moment in the evolution of American cinema. It's kind of ironic that it ends up taking place in France, but that you have this sort of, like, after the end of the Second World War, all these films that had been sort of, like, you know, developed and released over in the US during the Second World War being released on the market in one giant flood, and these French critics having to, like, process them and make sense of them and compress the entire history of, like, what's been happening in American cinema over the past 6 years down to a cohesive movement and a cohesive statement and a cohesive theory, which I suspect is a large part of why so much of like auteur theory and later on the kind of like modern film criticism theory developed from French, from Cahiers de Cinéma, in large part because I suspect like this is a concentrated shot. This is like everything that you could possibly need from American cinema in the 40s, but given to you in one go, like fed to you through a hose pipe and having to process that. Like, and I wonder if part of that might explain why, you know, we've talked a little bit about why Gilda is seen as a second tier film noir, you know, in terms of why it's considered, it's not, you know, everybody loves it. It's a recommendation that you get from people who know film noir and who love cinema, but it's not like The Maltese Falcon. It's not like Casablanca. It's not like Double Indemnity. And I wonder if part of that is down to the fact that it was released as part of that glut, in that like a lot of the discussions overseas by French critics would have been having this in the same conversation as like, you know, those sorts of films. And yeah, if that may have overshadowed it in some way, or over, like, kind of like, this one would have been easy to dismiss by comparison when you're watching Casablanca at the same time.
Because, I mean, that whole era of, like, French criticism and into the 50s is so fascinating, because if you, like, take a bit of a look at it, you know, there's all these really healthy debates going on about, you know, the value of, like, Hitchcock's work and stuff, and just a very kind of, and there's all sorts of like internecine rivalries between, you know, the different critics, and, you know, some of them are friends and some of them are not. But anyway, let's, I think we've already touched on the ending to an extent. I mean, it seems pretty unconvincing to me. It seems a bit rote. You know, you've got Gilda and Johnny's reconciliation. You've got this kind of soap opera flourish of Balin's reappearance, where, as you said, it's kind of signalled, you know, earlier on that he survived the plane crash and everything. And then you've got his death at the hands of, it's called Uncle Pio, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, this the last 5 minutes or so is not really the strongest aspect of the film as far as I'm concerned. It's kind of perfunctory in my view, and it sounds like you feel the same way.
It is. It feels like, this is when I talk about like the tension between the text and the subtext in the film. Like the subtext in the film is that these people are not at all happy, and that like Johnny is at the very least bi, but is also, you know, very clearly like in love with Balin as opposed to in love with Gilda. But because this is an American film that's being released in 1946 and has to be properly certified, the ending has to be Gilda and Johnny walking off into the sunset happily ever after, which makes you wonder like what the hell that marriage was like, because like you have this recurring motif that runs through the film where like Balin talks about how hate is the purest one, isn't it? Hate is an exciting emotion, haven't you noticed that? There's a heat in it that one can feel. And like Gilda repeats that sort of later on, almost verbatim to Johnny. And it makes you wonder, like, how healthy can this marriage possibly be? If the film's central thesis is that love is entwined with hatred to an extent that the two are indistinct, it's like there is no way that this marriage doesn't end with one of them shooting the other point blank with a gun some point in the next 5 years. But the film instead portrays it as this sort of like happy ever after, the point where the detective like goes, I'm a sucker for romance. By the way, I won't be prosecuting this murder. You two kids carry on as long as you tell me where the safe is. Which is like, again, this absurd happy ending. When he points out, he does point out that obviously it's self-defense and, you know,
yeah.
you know, it's double jeopardy, even though I'm not sure that's exactly how that works. But anyway, even though the film sort of makes this excuse for how this stuff's supposed to work, it is very perfunctory and it is very like, okay, you kids have had your fun, but now you have to like put all the toys away where they're supposed to go. And the writing and the writers who are turning in like script pages on the morning that they're shooting are like, oh, okay, I guess we'll do that then. And it does feel that. And I think, yeah, maybe that's another reason why the film isn't as highly rated as it is. And it is, if we're being honest, it's something that I'm not mad about as well. When I talk about like the issue that I have, the sort of the push and pull that I feel, I absolutely adore like the kinky stuff that's like the weird voyeurism subtext, the sexual repression subtext, the homoeroticism that's simmering just beneath the surface, this sort of interesting discussion about how, you know, masculinity, you know, is about largely blaming women for men's failings and treating them as like forces of nature rather than people with their own autonomy, and all that stuff that's really riveting that's bubbling beneath the surface. The issue is that the surface then goes, oh, and they lived happily ever after, despite the fact that everything we were saying was that they would throttle each other.
Yeah, and I think like we compared the film to Casablanca, I think Casablanca is a film that sort of turns that on its head, you know, where you have the main couple can't, you know, be together at the end of the film. Ingrid Bergman has to go back to Paul Henreid's character. And it's much more convincing in that film, you know, that the way it's resolved. I mean, I think we haven't really mentioned Charles Vidor. I think I mentioned him at the outset. But, you know, he just seems like he's one of these guys. You know, I've seen a couple of his films and, you know, sounded like, you know, he worked with Hayworth a few times. Sounded like he was very capable at working with actors. But he just seems like one of those guys, from what I've read and stuff, you know, kind of happy to turn his hand to any kind of picture, wasn't overly fussed about kind of implanting his own personal style on a film. And in a sense, I think Hollywood definitely needed filmmakers like that, I suppose. Even if the ones who've really flourished are people like Hawks or, you know, Hitchcock or whoever.
Or Wells, to bring it all back to Rita Hayworth. But yeah, again, this is the thing, though. You have to acknowledge that those, particularly at this point in cinema's history, were the outliers in that they were the ones who were pushing the medium forward. And it seems it's completely unreasonable to look at a director and go, well, you're not Orson Welles or you're not Howard Hawks or whatever. But I mean, I do think, yeah, there is something that holds this movie back from, I think, that A grade of like film noir that you're talking about, in that like those films that you cited, like The Maltese Falcon, Double Indemnity, Casablanca, they all feel ahead of their time in a very tangible way, and like in a way that you watch them today and they're still clever and they're still innovative. And I mean, even I'd include like Wells's work in this, like for example watching A Touch of Evil or watching Citizen Kane or anything like that, it's still dazzling even today. And I mean, I don't, that's not to be dismissive of Gilda, but as we've sort of pointed out, it is very much boxed in by the limitations of its time. It's very much defined by what it has to do in order to be a movie. You pointed out like the song and dance numbers, which feel like a studio obligation, the ending, which feels very much like something that comes out of left field with absolutely no foreshadowing, stuff like the clumsy narration from Johnny Farrell, which is there in case the audience can't understand via montage, or, you know, the people celebrating that the war is over, you have to actually have him say that the war is over. Stuff like having like Balin in the little boat just to show that he survived in case the audience don't necessarily get that. There's a sense that Gilda is like of its time in that respect, as much as all the interesting stuff is happening underneath. So I don't think it transcends the limitations of the system in the way that the other films do, but I have a hard time like judging it too harshly for that, you know?
Yeah, I think the film probably doesn't transcend those limitations. I think maybe Rita Hayworth's performance does. I suppose that's perhaps what I'd suggest anyway. All right, Darren. Well, I've really enjoyed chatting about Gilda with you. I mean, I guess before we go, we should let people know, you know, where they can find the movie blog, where they can find you online, and anything else you want to point people towards, really. So, yeah, take it away.
Perfect. Most of my stuff is available. You can follow my Twitter feed at Darren_Mooney. You can follow the 250, the podcast that we're discussing there at the 250. I write at the movie blog, but it's spelled with a 0 instead of an O in the word movie. But you can probably find it by Googling the movie blog Darren Mooney and it'll come up. I also co-host another podcast, the Scanon podcast, which is a contemporary weekly film news podcast focused on the Irish film industry, but in which we discuss like the new releases, the top 10, and what we watched this week as well. So that's very worth listening to. A whole bunch of young Irish critics who mostly know what they're talking about, and me. But yeah, so I'm really, really happy that it's a project that I've been sort of involved in and trying to get together that I'm very proud of.
Great stuff. Cheers, Darren. And you can find, listeners, you can find the podcast on Twitter at Movie Palace Pod, or you can search for us over on Facebook. It's just search for Movie Palace. You'd find the page I've set up. I think the next film we're going to be talking about, if people want to do rewatches or whatever, or first viewings, perhaps, the next film will be The Philadelphia Story.
Ooh.
Anyway, so listeners, I hope you can join us then next time when the curtain rises once more at the Movie Palace.